Now, my next guest is someone to whom you could quite happily say get lost, and she would take utterly no offence. In fact, I think she would be delighted at the prospect. Juliana Engberg is a great fan of the vaguely pointless meander. Her new book, En Route, it's a small countercultural treatise. It's all about getting lost. Juliana, welcome.
Good to see you, Jonathan.
Now, getting lost these days is a tricky thing because, you know, we've all got GPS in our pocket. It's hard to
It's almost impossible, you know, to get off the grid, to get off the highway, to get off the byway, wherever the GPS wants to take you. So I make a very deliberate decision to try and pervert that if I can. I plug in everything that goes, no tollways, no freeways, no highways, longest time to route, so that I can actually just get lost, meander, and see some stuff.
What's been your most wonderful lost experience?
It's fantastic because there's a security net under you, which is the GPS.
You can save yourself at any time.
You can save yourself, you know, and you can feel confident that if you've given yourself enough time, you'll probably get back on track and get back to where you needed to be. But meantime, you've seen a lot of things that have been hidden from view because they've taken you on these very precise routes that don't allow you actually to take in much of the cultural stuff that used to be part of the journey.
Well, give us an example how that has worked out particularly well in some instance for you.
Well, you know, I remember sort of going off track recently in France and finding myself in the middle of a wind farm, which I'm sure I wasn't supposed to be. But it was actually an awesome sight to actually be in the midst of this forest of wind turbines and hearing the whoo and everything like that. And it was a majestic kind of view because it was up high catching the wind. And I thought, this is really spectacular and I better get out of here before the security people find me. But it was a lot of fun. And you do find yourself in very peculiar and odd circumstances, not least, as I mentioned in the book, over a cliff, you know, so sometimes you have to be a little bit alert because the GPS meander might take you seriously off course.
Tell us about the perils of cliffs.
Yeah, well, you know, the GPS sometimes gets it wrong.
Yes.
You know, and it's not a precise science yet. So they might misrecognize a donkey track for a vehicle track, and before you know it, you're up a sort of, you know, Italian hillside and precariously finding yourself at the very edge of a ledge with no real turning ability. that can be actually quite challenging. But fortunately, I'm an excellent three-point turner. After about 23 times, you know, I generally can bring myself back to it.
That is the useful life skill. I mean, you have, as we've been discussing reservations about GPS, but you do, on your travels, develop rather intimate relationships with them. So tell us about Roxanne. And poor well-meaning but slow-witted Marcella.
Yeah. Well, Roxanne was my very first GPS assistant. It was quite a long time ago, back in the early 90s when I was in Los Angeles. And like many people, I find that you need to drive in Los Angeles because otherwise you won't get to anything. But it is a little bit sort of daunting because you're on the wrong side, etc. Anyway, I decided to go with the GPS, which was new technology, and I had this very abrasive woman telling me, left turn now, and, you know, right turn, please return to the highlighted route. And she was a very impatient kind of person, and we had quite a lot of arguments, to be really honest with you, because I eventually sort of knew the road route much better than she did and took advantage of, you know, Trader Joe's car park and things like that. But she had a cadence that was very alarming in a
sort
of way.
But this demands response. I mean, you know, you're travelling on the freeway. Decisions have to be made.
Yes. I mean, you know, I was grateful.
That's Roxanne's job.
I was grateful. And later, I think they developed, you know, Roxanne 2, who was a little less abrasive and a little bit more prepared to give you time to actually adjust to the fact that you might be doing a right turn in 500 yards or something of that sort. Marcella, by comparison, who was my GPS assistant in Italy, really had a lot of difficulty up in the Campania Australia kind of area. She really couldn't cope at all very well with the hilly bits and things of that sort. And it took me literally 10 hours to get to my destination, which was calculated to be achieved in 45 minutes.
With Marcella throwing her little digital hands up
yes,
in despair.
Yes, but she was very nice about it. She was less impatient than Roxanne. And I grew fond of her, as you must do with a GPS assistant. Otherwise, they would drive you nuts.
The voice is an important thing. I mean, I've not done this, but I do know people who have, for example, Michael Caine in their car.
Oh,
which I think
Alfie.
Of, you know,
Alfie. That, yeah. I think I could quite enjoy that, actually.
That would be
fun.
That would be a certain
yes,
something.
Yes, indeed. I hadn't heard that one. But, yeah, no, I mean, they do manufacture the voices very carefully. And, it's, of course, it's become a far better science, you know, as they've moved through moving into real voice, for instance, and making the nuances just a little more friendly. And you can now choose if you want to have somebody who is patient, for instance, or you can have somebody who is firm and assertive. So it just depends really on, I think, your own experience. I prefer someone who is patient and friendly. I don't want to actually drive with my driving instructor or my father from some time back, because that was an unpleasant experience, really. Nerve-wracking. He was hyperventilating, sweating all over the place. I'm talking about both of them,
actually. It's a tough thing to teach one's children to drive. it's a demanding moment in life. I see, what the GPS could do, I mean, if they were really on their game as programmers, would be to, you could put in the thing, get me lost.
Yeah.
Take me out of here. Just I don't care where it is, Marcella. Just take me somewhere where we neither of us know how
to get back.
Find me
a lovely spaghetti, you know, vongole somewhere, and I'll be as happy as Larry, you know.
You're not actually opposed necessarily to maps.
No, I love
you
maps.
You have a fondness for maps.
Yeah.
Which takes us to Venice.
Yes, indeed. Well, as probably you understand from reading the book, it's a bit of a meander structure itself. So I do go a little off topic here and there. I don't stick entirely on the GPS. So I got to thinking about what is being lost now that we have the GPS at our disposal. And I guess I think one of the things that maybe we're losing is physical maps, paper maps, which then took my thoughts to the most wondrous map, probably one of the great maps of the world, which is the De Barbari, which was made in 1315 by Jacopo De Barbari. And it is a fantastically large, for its time, isometric map of Venice. And it is still really very accurate to today. So if you look at that map, you think, my goodness, how on earth did he manage and his assistants to do that? Actually figure out every little palazzo, piazza, etc. All of those things that he's drawn in isometric ways, which is a little pop-up type of version of place. Yeah. And then I got to thinking, of course, you know, when I was a backpacker in the old days, you used to pick up those freebie maps, you know, in the metro or something in Paris, and they all had little isometric drawings.
Well, you can recognise the building.
Yes, indeed. You know, I mean, you couldn't see anything actually on the map around the building because they were out of scale. But you know, they were charming all the same. And I do love maps. And I remembered then as a kid, I used to draw maps, fantasy maps, you know, which actually gave me a bit of a sense of how geographers and cartographers usually organise space for you to understand.
There's a human desire to sort of, you know, place ourselves spatially like that, to sort of understand our environment.
It's always very comforting. When you get a little sign that says you are here,
yes,
you know,
yes, I like
mean
that.
That's comforting, and then you can't really work out the orientation,
which is always useful in Venice.
Yes, indeed,
you are here. Really? Oh, goodness.
Well, Venice is a very challenging space, as anyone who's been there would know, and it is often used by cartographers and wayfinders to actually understand how we can better navigate, or what are the clues to better navigation. So they've found that, you know, left, right, you know, is very helpful. But if you can actually bring together other signages or recognition points, that is going to be a far more helpful form of navigating. So if you say to somebody, go left, go right, then you will see a florist. And then you will see this actually helps people to orient themselves, and you go, ah, yes, of course, that is the most helpful.
And I love to find out that you were, as I was as a child, a fan of strip maps, which used to be produced by our motoring organisations, the NRMA or the RACV.
Love
fantastic
a strip map.
Things.
Love a strip map. You know, the information.
For the children listening, describe.
Yeah, okay, so a strip map, children listening, is a longitudinal form map, so, you know, long, not not sort of landscape format. And it takes you literally on your main journey. And alongside that are all these beautiful little descriptions of places that you're passing, little monuments that you might see. And it was a fantastic way of learning the land and a fantastic way of learning the culture of our space. And of course, you know, I'm part of that generation who used to hit the road with the family and go on the long drive, sometimes insufferably with my father who wouldn't stop, and you know, see this big land, because that's what we did in the early 60s. But recently, an older friend of mine said, what's a strip map? So I realise it has a very specific reference for a generation of people for whom
very much
car travel was the thing. Young people probably wouldn't also know about it because we tend to now travel in planes.
Well, and car travel too. I mean, you know, navigating once upon a time the Hume Highway, for example, when it was just two lanes with a little white stripe in the middle.
Yes, I am that old.
And that was a challenge.
It was really a challenge.
You don't actually need navigational aids now to drive from Sydney to Melbourne.
No,
it's pretty well signposted.
Yeah, but you want to get off that. You know, I think that you want to take the opportunity, if you're doing that kind of a journey, to take the byways and just go into some of those gorgeous little towns that are really beautiful, you know, up near Bright and Euroa and all of those sorts of places, because that's where culture was created, that's where our stories were made, and that's where our narratives, you know, were drawn. And so I think it's a pity if people don't go off the beaten track. It's really lovely to actually reacquaint or first acquaint yourself with places that, you know, have much to tell us about the way we are, the way we were. Of course, it is interesting. A geography friend of mine tells me that because the main highways now have actually sidelined those little towns, they are much more integral because the freeway doesn't go through them anymore. So they're actually reunited as a community. And that's also working. So that's interesting too.
Juliana, my GPS is telling us that we are now at our destination.
Heavens, so. That was a quick journey.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Juliana Egberg is a curator and an author of a fabulous little book. Check it out, En Route. We'll pop a link up on the blueprint page on the RN website.